It's a pleasure. Those of you who've been listening into our conversation, I'm catching up. I mean, I met Rabbi Fine. When did we meet? How many years ago? We met when J.J. Schechter, Rabbi J.J. Schechter, ran these Yarche Kalas.
I think it was 21 years ago.
Yeah, 21 years ago in Boston, in Maimonides, sitting in the School of Maimonides, where Rav Soloveitchik was at the Soloveitchik Institute, that J.J. Schechter was running back then. And Rabbi Fine was the rabbi in where Overland Park, Kansas City. And I didn't even know he had made Aliyah, but he's been living in Israel here since 2008. I mean, I knew recently, but 2008 is, and as you heard, two of his kids are now in the army. Before he was rabbi in Kansas City, he was rabbi in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and he's the founder of the Barkai Center for Practical Rabbinics and Community Development in Israel. And he lives in Modi'in, teaches at the Amudim Seminary, where Rabbi Sachs also teaches, I believe, right? Jeffrey Sachs also teaches there. And it's a pleasure to welcome him, and I want to give him a special Yasher Koach. It's 3:30 in the morning, and he really volunteered he signed up, no pressure. I didn't even know he signed up on his own to get up at 3:30 in the morning to teach Torah. So, Vakasha, Rabbi Fine, it's all yours.
Okay. Thank you so much, Rabbi Kelman. It's always a pleasure. I guess I should share my screen. Let's see if I still remember how to do that. You can see the source sheet? Yes?
Fine. Yeah.
Okay, good. Okay, I apologize. I haven't given a share in Zoom since, like I said, since COVID. So I hope it all goes okay. So as I was saying, first of all, it's my pleasure to be here, really my honor. And I'll wake up at whatever time in the morning it is to teach Torah. As I was saying to Rabbi Kelman, who I thank very much for inviting me, at the beginning, for those of you who may have been listening, this is my bar mitzvah parsha, Ki Teitzei. I'm 55 years old. So this is the 42nd anniversary of my bar mitzvah. You shouldn't wish me a happy birthday, because, I went to, camp. My birthday was during the summer. It's at the end of July, usually, Chaf Zayin Tammuz, and all my friends were in camp, and I wouldn't have had anyone in my bar mitzvah, so my parents made my bar mitzvah around 6 or 7 weeks late so that my friends would be at camp. So that's why this is my bar mitzvah parsha. Anyway, three things have always sort of enraptured me about Parsha Ki Teitzei since I read it, 42 years ago. And I'll just briefly, I mean, there are a lot of things to say about Parsha Ki Teitzei, but three overall topics have, sort of always interested me. One is three of the laws in Parsha Ki Teitzei, seem to be, against our very basic, morality, right? Just to give one example of them, perhaps the most famous example is, Amalek, right? The command to kill Amalek. It's the children of Amalek. It's not their fault that their ancestors did what they did to us. And nevertheless, we're commanded to root them out, right? The same is true about the Mamzer. The Mamzer is not the bastard son. It's not his fault what happened to him. It's his parents' fault. And nevertheless, he's punished. And thirdly, the rule of the wicked and rebellious son, the Ben Sora Moreh. I didn't do that in order, but... Also, we are told by the rabbis and quoted by Rashi in this week's parsha that he's nidon al shem sofo, right? That he's killed now because of what will happen to him later on in life. And that's sort of against what we believe, right? We believe in repentance and the ability to change and all that. So that seems to be one theme in Parsha Ki Teitzei. Another theme in Parsha Ki Teitzei seems to be a very random collection of halachot, of laws, of mitzvot, right? According, there are various counts of the Torah, of the mitzvot in the Torah, but according to, I think it's Sefer Achinuch, we have 74 mitzvot of 613 in Parsha Ki Teitzei. And if you look at it, it all seems to be very random, right? And in general, I often say that, if a eighth grade student would, write the Torah out to me and hand it in to me, and I was an English teacher, an English composition teacher, and I didn't know this was the Torah, I would probably wouldn't give it a very big good mark, because it doesn't a very good grade. It doesn't seem to be in any kind of order. It all seems to be kind of random. Things are repeated. Different words are used for the same thing. So obviously that's a very cursory look at the Torah, but at the outset, one could say that it doesn't seem to make any sense. And the third topic, which I'd like to spend some time talking with you about tonight, is the idea of what is often called in the literature narrative and law, right? There are two seeming categories about the way certain things are written in the Torah. And one of them seems to be narrative, or that's a more popular, you know, it's a more common word for a story, a more fancy word for story. And there's law, right? So usually law is what we call apodictic, right? A-P-O-D-I-C-T-I-C, right? And that's also just a fancy word for commanding, right? Meaning you shall do this, you shall keep the Shabbat, you shall not steal, you shall not kill, whatever it may be, right? Where God just sort of commands, the Torah just commands. And then we have stories, right? You know, we're all familiar with stories from the Torah. The story starts off with the Torah. The Torah starts off with the story, right? It starts off with the creation of the world, right? The very first verse of the Torah is a story, right? And so, what we see in Parsha Ki Tetzeh, just to sort of cut to the chase, is that law is told in narrative form, right? So if you just take a look at the very first source, right, which is the first pasuk from this morning's, from this week's Parsha, Ki Tetzeh l'melchama alei becha unitana Hashem l'kacha b'yadecha v'shavita shavya, right? It's about the law, the mitzvah of the Yefei Toar, this beautiful woman who, if you're in war and you want to, have relations with, you have to do certain things. You can't just take her right away. But the Torah doesn't say, you shall not do this. It tells a story, right? It says, Ki teitzei lamilchama alevecha unitano Hashem elokecha biyadecha v'shavita shavya. It says, if you go out to war, or some would translate ki as when you go out to war, but if you go out to war against your enemies, and God will deliver you into their hands, right? And you take his captives, right? Then if X all happens, which we just read, then Y, right? Then you are allowed to do certain things, but you have to take certain precautions, right? And we see right away that this bothered the classical commentators, right? If you look at the Or HaChaim, who's Rabbi Chaim ben Attar, who late 17th century, I think he was born in 1696, right? He says right away, his first comment on this, on the Parsha, on the first Pasuk, he says, Sarich ladad, lama hutzrach lomar kol zeh, right? We have to wonder why all this was needed to be said. Shelo hayaki tetzel melchama avecha, right? The Torah didn't need to say this. Sarich lomar ela ki tira b'shivya esha v'gomer, right? It just needed to say, if you see a woman in captive, then etc., then this is the law. Why did God have to tell us the whole story? Oh, you're going to go out to a war and God is going to give the enemy into your hands, right? Why is this happening? Why does the Torah need to command law in the form of a story, right? And if you look in this morning, I keep on saying this morning, I mean, Shabbat's Parsha, in Parsha Ki Tetzeh, you'll see that almost all of the laws that are given in this form, which really raises a question. And it really raises a much more broad question. And it really goes back to the very beginning of the Torah itself, right? And that question is, excuse me, what is the Torah, right? What is the Torah? Is the Torah a book of law? Is the Torah a book of history? Right. I think we could probably make the claim that it can't really be either one of those only. Right. It can't be a book of law, because if it was just a book of law, a lot of the Torah is telling us a story. Right. It can't be just a book of history, because if it was just a book of history, then it doesn't seem to be a very good book of history. It leaves out almost everything that happened. It only tells us stories that are important to the Jewish people. It only tells stories about a certain groups of people, certain families, certain individuals, right? It leaves out much of, if not most of, what happens. And we know that this really is what concerned the commentators from the very, very beginning of the Torah. So if you look at source two, right, you see Breshit Bara Elokim, right? At the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And we know that Rashi's very famous commentary at the beginning of the Torah addresses this very point, right? Rashi says, Amar Rabbi Yitzchak. If you see, I'm reading in Rashi here. Breshit Amar Rabbi Yitzchak. Lo hayat tzarich lachil et haTorah ela mehakodesh hazeh lachem shi mitzvah rishona shenitztavah by Yisrael uma tam patach b'vreshit. Right. So Rashi brings this very question up at the very beginning of the Torah. Right. The Torah really, if the Torah was a book of law, then the Torah didn't need to start until the 12th chapter of the book of Exodus, where the first mitzvah that the entire Jewish people as a people is given, right? The mitzvah of Kiddush HaKodesh, the mitzvah of sanctification of the new moon, right? And nevertheless, the Torah was given from the beginning of Breishit. And we know that according to the Sefer HaChinuch, there are only three commandments that are quote unquote given in the book of Breishit, or counted at least. I say quote unquote given because if you read them, and we will read some of them as we go along tonight, most of them are not given as mitzvot. Most of them come out or are derived as mitzvot by the rabbis, from stories that occur. So I just put this pasuk from the beginning of Breishit in, and Rashi, in order to show that this is a question that we have grappled with for a very, very long time, right? So I've never taught this class before, so I don't really know whether there's all that much participation, but I guess I would just ask, right, before we go any further, like, does anyone here have any kind of idea or any kind of theory why the Torah would necessarily command in the form of a story? What do we gain by that, or what can be taught to us by that? Anybody? Are you allowed to take yourself off mute?
Well, it makes it more interesting and more palatable to have a story. People like stories.
Right. Right. Okay, good. So if the Torah just said, oh, do this, do that, don't do this, don't do that, it would sort of be kind of boring, right? So yeah, it makes it very, it makes it much more riveting, much more interesting to sort of contextualize the commandments with stories. Okay, good. Anybody else? Okay, so if not, then let's go on. I wanted to show you in 3 and 4 that this is not just Noreen. Is that you that just spoke?
I was just going to say that, the Torah is a book of how do you live your life. So it's not just a matter of, following a law. It's what are your values? And it's that involves a lot more than law.
Right. Right. Okay. And so thank you, Noreen, very much. And that actually I was going to say this at the end, but I'll cut to the chase now that you said that. Yes. And I would say that when we say, what is a Torah? Is it a book of law? Is it a book of history? I think that you're really correct that most people would say that the Torah, right? Torah comes from the Hebrew root hora'ah, right? Which is to instruct or instruction. And yes, I believe you're 1,000% correct that the Torah is a book of instruction that teaches us how to live, exactly as you put it. And in order to teach us how to live, the Torah uses different methods in order to do that. So sometimes it speaks one way, sometimes it speaks another way, but it's not one thing. It's an entire thing that tries to employ many different methodologies in terms of being able to instruct us in terms of how to live our lives. So I thank you for both of your comments. I think you're very much right. I wanted to in 3 and 4 show you that. I'm reading the comments also. Sorry. Stories equal word pictures. Excellent, right? A story is worth 1,000 words. Stories illustrate the circumstances. Correct. Stories allow you to read yourself into them. Very good. So, Jennifer, thank you. So, all very good comments, but the last one about allowing you to read yourself into them, I think is going to become, you know, hopefully my major point, as we go on. Thank you so much. So, in 3 and 4, I wanted to show you, just very briefly, because we're studying Torah here, not legal theory or leadership or whatever that may be, but, this is very much a topic in legal studies in general, having nothing to do with Judaism, right? And if you would go and not during the class, of course, but if after the class you were to pop it, type into Google, you know, narrative and law or something like that, you would see many, 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 things written, over many, many years about, legal systems and law and narrative and law. So this is not just a Jewish issue. One of the most well-known and prominent scholars of law, Robert Cover, who wrote about this in number 3, wrote the following, right? No set of legal institutions, or here I'm right here in number 3, or prescriptions exists apart from the narratives that locate it and give it meaning, right? So in that one sentence, he's basically saying that you cannot really have a legal system that exists apart from some kind of narrative, right? Meaning nothing has real meaning outside its context, right? For every constitution, there is an epic, for each decalogue, a scripture. Once understood in the context of the narratives that give it meaning, law becomes not merely a system of rules to be observed, but a world in which we live. Law and narrative are inseparably related, right? So when I do that, when I say that at the beginning, that it is the Torah book of law, or is the Torah this or that, right? Meaning I'm being very artificial. You can't separate these things out. It's one big picture, right? It's a gestalt, as we say. And law is just one part of it. So if you were just to take the law out and leave everything aside, the narrative, there would be no way to contextualize it. And as Jennifer said, there would be no way to really put ourselves into the picture, right? As he says at the end, they are inseparably related. Okay, number 4 is a gentleman by the name of Howard Gardner. Howard Gardner is a professor of education and psychology at Harvard University, and he wrote some very well-known and important leadership books, you know, during our time. And one of them, or perhaps the most popular one, is called Leading Minds. I sort of summarized it. Okay, Gardner's argument is that what makes a leader is the ability to tell a particular kind of story, one that explains ourselves to ourselves and gives power and resonance to a collective vision. So Churchill told the story of Britain's indomitable courage in the fight for freedom. Gandhi spoke about the dignity of India and nonviolent protest. Margaret Thatcher talked about the importance of the individual against an ever-encroaching state. Martin Luther King Jr. told of how a great nation is colorblind. Stories give the group a shared identity and a sense of purpose. I think we see right away here something that I think we all know, right? That the ability to succeed in life, and especially to lead in life, is to be able to tell a story. You know, storytelling today is a very big art. It always was an art, but today it's sort of being commercialized, right? I run my own organization. It's called Barkai. Rabbi Kalman mentioned at the beginning. What we do is we train Israeli rabbis in practical rabbinics. The whole notion of community as it exists in North America is not really all that prevalent here in Israel. And rabbis here are not really, don't really serve anything more than just a halachic and sort of teaching role. They don't necessarily fulfill in any widespread way, the sort of communal leadership role that they do, you know, outside of Israel. So we're trying to implement that vision in Israel more than it exists now. But this is not supposed to be an advertisement for myself. But in order to run your own organization, you have to raise a lot of money, right? And so I involve myself, you know, every day in raising money. And this is, I'm only trying to put this in context. I'm not trying to raise money here. What I'm trying to say is that in the fundraising world today, right? There are many people trying to, peddle their ware in terms of the ability to tell a story. So they have storytelling workshops and storytelling conferences and all kinds of things about how, right? It's fundraising and running an organization is not just about doing something and saying, this is what we do and give me money, but it's about telling a story, right? And I'm just saying that about myself and about what I do, but I think any of us could probably say that what we do is a story, right? That our families are a story and our personal lives are a story and et cetera, et cetera. So I think that that's a good way of sort of contextualizing our lives. And he says, Gardner knows that the right anecdote can be worth 1,000 theories, and he is best when he shows it instead of tells. For example, rather than write at length, I just put this here because everyone's been seeing this movie, Oppenheimer, right? Rather than write at length on how Oppenheimer's leadership sometimes failed because of his arrogance, Gardner gives a single indelible example, et cetera. I didn't want to necessarily get into the whole example, but I think that what Howard Gardner here is saying is something that we very much feel, right? And we very much experience, and we very much see in our lives, right? The ability to succeed in life and to convey a message and to bring people to a cause, whether it's Martin Luther King doing what he did or David Fine trying to raise money for Barkai and everything in between, right? It's that in order to bring people to a cause, you have to be able to tell them a story. And if you can't succeed at doing that, then you're really not going to succeed. So Jennifer, so if we introduce the concept of power, does it belong to the one who shapes the narrative? You want to say a little bit more about that, what you mean? I think I know what you mean, but.
Oh, and sorry, my video is off. It's just I'm not at the most opportune moment.
It's all right.
Viewing. Anyway, and your lecture is fascinating. Thank you. And for all you're doing in Israel. I think what I mean is that there's no, I guess, if one takes the view, there's no definitive story. It's how you shape it,
right,
to your advantage, and hopefully that's a positive and ethical one. That's, I guess, what I mean.
Right. So I think you're 1,000% right. Meaning, you know, we live in a world today, and I don't want to get into anything, but like where you know, basic truths are always questioned, and you know, everyone sort of has their own truth, and so I think in some ways you could say, well, there really are not necessarily, you know, in today's world, maybe no facts, right? Meaning the person who introduces the story or who tells the story is the one who creates all the facts, right? And therefore, there very much is a concept of power. So I think you're 1,000% right that I think we start with the assumption that the Torah, you know, given by God is coming from an ethical and moral place that, it's not interested in power. It's just interested in morality and ethics and about, you know, bringing a greater good to the world. Okay. Sapiens by Yuval Harari talks about stories and why weaker apes, band together by stories to defeat much stronger apes or animals. Okay. I've always had that on my, to read list. So maybe that will help me get to it sooner rather than later. But yeah, okay, great. Good point. Thank you very much. Okay, number five is the last sort of secular source that I want to use tonight. This is Alasdair. I never knew how to say his name. I think you said Alasdair MacIntyre. He is a non-Jewish philosopher that lives in Scotland. I believe that he's still alive and that he's in his 90s today. And I actually learned about Alasdair MacIntyre from Rabbi Jonathan Sacks. He quotes him from time to time, actually quite often. There was a book that was published a bunch of years ago in honor of Rabbi Jonathan Sacks. I forget the name of it. It's blue. I have it in my mind. Anyway, there's an essay in this book in honor of Rabbi Jonathan Sacks. By MacIntyre, and he writes many books, but one of them is called After Virtue, and he wrote, "Man in his actions and practice, as well as in his frictions, is essentially a storytelling animal. This is a very, very well-known quote, right? That's what humans do. They tell a story. Deprive children of stories and you leave them unscripted, anxious stutterers in their action as in their worlds, right? So I think what I'm trying to say, and I think this is rather obvious, you don't necessarily need me to say it, that if the Torah would just come and try and instruct, like we said, Hora'ah Lehorot, just by telling us what to do, it would fail, right? That we have to put everything into contextualize everything. And if we're unable to do that, then we are going to fail. So I don't, I want to show you a few other examples, in this week's Parsha and some in general in the Torah. And then I want to try and spend, based on some of these sources, a little bit more in depth of, you know, why the Torah does this. I think we got to a basic understanding of why the Torah does this and why, how it helps to further the Torah's goal of instruction. Okay. So, I want to go back to something that I sort of touched on before, right? We know that there's this idea that there are 613, commandments in the Torah, right? This is a tradition that comes to us. If you would open the Torah and read the entire Torah and you would count every time it says, you shall do this, you shall not do that, do this, don't do that, it would be way more than 613. It would be many, many thousands. And for whatever reason that we won't go into right now, there's this tradition that there are 613 commandments. So I think it's fairly widely known that there is not actually a lot of fairly educated people don't necessarily know this, but there's not necessarily agreement as to what those 613 commandments are. So we have many, we have a whole genre of literature in the rabbinic literature called Sifrei HaMitzvot, the various works that enumerate the commandments, right? Perhaps the most famous is the Sefer HaChinuch, but the Rambam does this, the Ramban does this, there's the Sefer HaMitzvot HaGadol, the Sefer HaMitzvot HaKatan, and several others, and different, these different scholars have different, theories of categorization and what makes something into a mitzvah. But anyway, according to the Sefer HaChinuch's count, right, as we said, there are three mitzvot that are given in the book of Genesis. Okay. So the first one comes from the Parshat Bereishit itself, and it's Pru Urvu, you shall be fruitful and multiply, which comes from in number six here, the first chapter of Genesis, the 28th verse, by Vayivarech Otam Elokim, Vayomer Lahem Elokim, Pru Urvu Umelu Haaretz V'Chishua, Uridu B'Dgarayam Uvov HaChamayim V'Kol Chaya HaRames Haaretz. And God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth, and subdue it, and rule over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the sky, and over all the beasts that tread upon the earth. Now, if you take notice, right, this is only 28 verses into the Torah. We read the first verse of the Torah a few minutes ago. The beginning of the Torah is a story, right? In the beginning, God created, he did this, he did that. And we know that this is just part of the story. This doesn't seem at all to be a commandment, right? Yes, it does say, and he said, God said to them, be fruitful and multiply. It does sound like a commandment, but actually, if you look at most of the commentators on this verse, most of the classical commentators, they claim that this is not a commandment, but rather it's a blessing, right? Vayivarech otam, and God bless them. It's a blessing that human beings will have many, many progeny. But if we look at this Sefer HaChinuch in the first mitzvah, right, we see that the Sefer HaChinuch, based on the Midrash and other, you know, and the rabbis, claims that this is a commandment, right? And I'm sorry, I couldn't find, I'm sure Rabbi Kelman probably in 2 seconds can find the Sefer HaChinuch in English online, but I'm not all that technologically aware. So I'll just try and read this and translate it, right? Breishit yesh ba mitzvah aseh achat. Right, there is one in Parshat Bereishit. There is one positive commandment, and the he mitzvah pri arvia, and this is the commandment of be fruitful and multiply, as it says, and God blessed them, and he said, be fruitful and multiply. And then, as always, the Sefer HaChinuch tries to sort of give a reason for the commandment. Right, the whole notion of whether we should search out the reason for the commandments is a whole big medieval debate. But for various reasons, there were people that said that we shouldn't try and search out the reasons for the commandments, but the Sefer HaChinuch very much was in the other camp. And he says, Mishar Shea Mitzvah, right, the root of the reason, meaning the reason for this mitzvah, Kidei Sheyehe Ha'olam Yushav, so that the world should be settled, Shashem Baruch Hu Chafetz B'Yeshuvo, that God desired the settlement of the world, right? And he quotes a verse from Isaiah, V'hi Mitzvah Gedola, okay, and it's a very important commandment, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? The exact reasons for the commandment, while important, are not necessarily my point tonight, right? But what my point is that here, the Sefer HaChinuch is sort of trying to give us God's thinking, right? God just, you know, created all sorts of things. He created the sun and the moon and the earth and the animals and the sun, all the different things, right? And then at the very end of this process, right, he creates human beings. And I think that what the Sefer HaChinuch is trying to tell us is that we're God's partners in the world, right? We're sort of the apex of creation. And God has been doing this, and he created us in order to sort of forward a goal, right, of settling this world and becoming his partners in creation. And that's why we have to be fruitful and multiply. It's not just some kind of random command, right? But it's a command that is at the very, very epicenter of what it means to be not only Jewish, but to be a human being, right? To partner with God to bring about greater good to perfect the world, right? And if God had just said, or the Torah had just said, be fruitful and multiply without giving us this story about the creation of the world and what that means and how powerful God is. And God didn't only think about the sun and the moon, the big heavenly spheres, the powerful, which everyone sees, but he cares about us and about not only about human beings in corporate as a corporate entity, but he cares about me and he cares about you, right? The command is to human beings, right? It is in plural, pruvru, but God is talking to each one of us. And if God didn't tell us that story, then we wouldn't necessarily get the same kind of feeling that we do once it is part of the story. And I only bring the Sefer HaChinuch in order to show that, because I think that that's really what's at the back of the Sefer HaChinuch's mind as well, right? How do we take this from its context? Because it's not given as it doesn't seem to be given as a mitzvah, but how do we sort of mitzvahize it and enable this act to sort of carry out the greater story? Okay, so I think the same thing is true about about another mitzvah that is sort of derived from the book of Genesis, and that is the Gid Hanasha, okay, the vein that we're not allowed to eat in an animal, right? And this comes from Breishit 32 in source 8, Parsha Vayishlach. And without reviewing the whole story, we know that the angel or whoever it was fought against Yaakov. It was Esau's angel. And at the end of this battle or whatever it was, Esau was injured and limping because of this angel that attacked him or that fought with him, whatever it may be. And that is the reason why we don't eat the Gid Hanasha. So here, first, if we just look at the verse, right, there's no command whatsoever, right? Here, there's a very long story, which I didn't put on the source sheet, but because it was very long, but feel free to review it afterwards, right? The verse says, therefore, the children of Israel may not eat the displaced tendon, which is on the socket of the hip, until this day, for he being the angel, touched the socket of Jacob's hip in the hip sinew, right? So it basically, if it weren't for the story, there wouldn't even be a law. It's not that the law came and then we need sort of some details to fill it in, right? A story happened. We're required. God wanted us to remember this story this story to have an effect on our lives and on what we do in life, right? And therefore he commanded us this law, right? So it's the story creates the law in the first place. So I think that means that we're not commanded not to eat the Gid Hanasha just so that we remember the story. We're supposed to remember the story for as Jennifer was saying before, for ethical and moral reasons, right? In order to partner with Hashem, like I said at the beginning, and make the world a better place, right? Perhaps it's that we're remembered. There could be we could spend a lot of time, talking about what this story asks us to remember and why and what kind of effect it should have as we continue our lives and continue our history of a Jewish people. You know, I suggest that you all think about that on your own. I just want to read one comment of
Rabbi Pani.
Somebody wants to say something?
Yes, in terms of clarification, the Gid HaNoshe is referred as the sinew, which is a tendon, but I think what is really meant is the sciatic nerve.
Ah. Okay.
No, I can you clarify your
Okay. In general, when I take translations, I try and do it from like a Jewish translation, not a Christian one, right? Because I'm not sure of the like specifics in terms of the makeup of the body. I think you're right. I think it's the sciatic nerve. I think it's just the way that this translation translated. Whatever it may be.
Not good. Right. Okay.
Whatever it may be, yes. What I'm trying to say is, let's just call it the Gid HaNoshe for lack of a good English or the sciatic nerve.
Yes.
We're not allowed to eat that. What I'm saying is because the command follows or is a result of the story. I wanted to read with you Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor, the Bechor Shor, which is a very important but lesser studied and lesser known classic commentary. Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor, 12th century, Orléans, France. He rewrites, Al-Kain lo yachlu b'nei Yisrael liyot lahem lezikaron, right? Why? He offers this opinion, right? It should be a memory. Ki avihem nilcham im ha-malach v'lo yacholo, that their father, meaning Jacob, fought with the angel and he wasn't able to overcome him. I guess he was, but not without, being hurt. L'kach naga b'kaf yarchal b'makam chigin ha-shev. Hu zikaron kavod ugdola. Hold on. Where am I here? Yeah, so, Wait, am I going in the right order? Yeah, so whatever. I it's not that he's necessarily right, Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor. We could come up with many, many reasons what we're supposed to remember. But this is one important thing that we should remember, right? That I think what he's saying is that, our father fought and we're always fighting and whatever it may be. I didn't necessarily bring this Bechor Shor in order to get into the meat of the reason that he's suggesting that we're commanded to remember this, but that there are a lot of different theories as to what specifically we are supposed to remember. But the overall point is that, once again, I didn't bring the Sefer HaChinuch here because I didn't want to make it the source sheet even longer, but this is the source for the mitzvah in the Sefer HaChinuch. And again, if you read this and you didn't know anything else, you would not think that this was a command, right? And I that just goes back to what I said before, that the Sefer HaChinuch is trying to, again, put all of our, all of our laws in context and try and understand what the bigger picture is here. Okay. I guess I skipped a number here. That's what's mixing me up. Anyway, there's 9, which is Deuteronomy 24, and 8, what we just read. So let's call this 8a. Okay. 8a. Rashi. In Dvarim Parsha Kitetze, Parakafe, Pasuk Yud Aleph. Okay, so there's a well-known teaching of the rabbis. I said at the beginning that it doesn't seem like these stories or these rules have anything to do with each other. So the first 3 laws of the Parsha, right, the Eshet Yifat Toar, the beautiful woman captive, right, then the second law, the Isha Snua, the hated wife, there's 2 wives. One is beloved, one is hated. And then the Ben Sorer Umore, the wicked and rebellious son, right? And there doesn't necessarily seem to be there doesn't seem to be any rhyme or reason as to why these stories follow each other, right? So I had a teacher in college who used to say that the Rishonim and us, and or even the Rishonim and the Bible critics, ask the same questions, right? Our answers are just different, right? So the Rishonim will say, why do these three things follow each other when there doesn't seem to be a reason? And they'll say, well, there is a reason, right? The Bible critics will say, well, that may prove that there are different authors of the Bible and edited, you know, at some later date. I'm not getting into all of that right now, but this question that anybody would read, would think of when reading the first three commandments of our Parsha, would think of, right, was asked already by the rabbis, right? So this, let's read it in English, okay? This Rashi is on the verse, v'lakachta lecha isha, and you may take her for yourself as a wife, talking about the Eisha Yifat Torah. And now that you are commanded to take this woman as a wife, but scripture in permitting this marriage is speaking only against the evil inclination, which drives him to desire her. So let's just put this in context, right? A man goes out to war, right? We may not like this law today. It may not really speak to us. It may seem a little, not make us uncomfortable. And I agree with that, but that's the subject for a different year. Let's just take it as it is right now, right? A man goes out to a milchemet reshut, an optional war, right? And the Torah allows him to take a woman captive under certain circumstances, right? Because the reasoning of the rabbis is that he's going to do it anyway. For if the Holy One, blessed is he, would not permit her to him, he would take her illicitly. The Torah teaches us, however, that if he marries her, right? So now what will happen? The Torah, this is actually coming as a warning, Rashi is telling us, that the Torah is teaching us that if he marries her, like the Torah allows the man to marry her, right? Halachically, it's permissible, right? But it's a warning that if he does this, he will ultimately come to despise her. As it says, after this, if a man has two wives, one beloved and the other despised, moreover, he will ultimately father through her a wayward and rebellious son. For this reason, these passages are juxtaposed. So the idea being here that this whole, all these rules of the first three rules are one big story, right? Which would not be commanded to us were this not human nature and were this story not told to us, right? So I think that the law here is meeting the human, right? And that it's sort of allowing a human to sort of live in the way that we know that he's going to live, even if it may not be the most ideal way, because he has certain urges, certain you know, desires. But if he lives that way, then there are going to be various consequences. So again, if you read the first three laws of the Torah, it's one big story. And if it weren't told to us this way, it wouldn't really be, you know, talking to our lives. And in order for a law to talk to our lives, it has to put us into the story, as someone said earlier. Anyway, I want to see Jay. It is almost a dying art to know the difference between human shuman, permitted fats, and chaylev, forbidden fats. It requires very.
Not really relevant to what you're talking about now. We can do it later. That was just on the.
Comments. Okay, sorry. Okay, good. Thank you.
Ignore
okay.
it. That, that's
good. Good. Okay, thank you. Okay, I think a very good example of this comes from also this week's parsha. You don't even have to read any Rashi, any commentaries. I think that it just speaks out to us from the verses itself. You know that I remember speaking at my bar mitzvah about. I don't really remember it all that well, I'll be honest with you. My father happened to have made me this very nice, like, scrapbook with all these things from my bar mitzvahs, a lot of cards that people gave me and whatever. And in there is my speech. So every once in a while, I like read it to myself just to remind myself. So I don't really remember it. It's only because, my father was kind enough to do that for me. Anyway, let's just read this in English in 9, right? You shall not withhold the wages. So anyway, at my bar mitzvah, I tried to speak about the great morality and ethical nature of the Torah, right? We always, or not we, but perhaps people often think of the Torah as, you know, again, a book of ritual law and all kinds of, you know, strange kind of things. And you shall, you know, you'll put a wrap a dead cow around your arm every morning and eat certain kinds of foods, right? But so that I'm not downplaying those are very important laws, but I think it's much easier to understand sort of the ethical and moral mitzvot that the Torah commands us, and many of them are in this week's Parsha, and then they're very much interspersed with the ritual law. So we often like to bifurcate in our minds, and I think what the Torah is trying to teach us is that everything, every law has a little bit of everything in it. But anyway, it says, you shall not, Deuteronomy chapter 24, verse 14, you shall not withhold the wages of a poor or destitute hired worker, of your brothers or of your strangers who are in your land within your cities. You shall give him his wage on his day and not let the sun set over it, for he is poor and he risked his life for it, so that he should not cry out to the Lord against you, so that there should be sin upon you. You shall not pervert the judgment of a stranger or of an orphan, and you shall take a widow's garment as security for a loan. Okay, so very nice. We have to be very kind, and we have to be very just, and we have to worry about everyone in society, everything that is a hallmark for Judaism. But what you'll notice here is that these laws are apodictic, right? These laws are not in the form of a story, much different from many of the laws that I've been talking about tonight. But what is very interesting here, right? It says in the last pasuk, you shall remember that you were a slave in Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you from there. Therefore, I command you to do this day, right? So let's say that the Torah would have stopped, right, without that verse, okay? And we just would have read that. So we said, nice, yes, that's very important. It's very just. We have to worry about everything. But once the Torah includes that pasuk, right, then it's put into our story, right? It's not just some nice law, but we have to remember that we wanted people to act this way towards us when we were slaves in the land of Egypt, right? And if we remember that and we always keep that in mind, then this, I think it's obvious that the laws will have much more of a powerful effect than if we were just told to do them, even if we think that they're nice, you know, just, kind laws. So I think this is a perfect example. Even though the laws here are apodictic, I think it's very clear that the Torah is asking us to put everything into the context of a story. Okay. So sex and violence appetite is stronger than food appetite and cannot be restrained, not be restrained, only channeled. Okay. That, you know, this is an important question, and it's an important topic. And why the Torah picks to, chooses to sort of channel certain, desires and urges and forbids others. I'm not denying that that's an important question, but I only have 11 minutes left. So I'm gonna, honorably leave that for a different time, because I would like to, I think this is an important idea, and I would like to try and get to the end, and not only get to the end, but allow time for a certain amount of discussion if the time allows us. Okay, now the last source, which I think is rather important and says a lot, is actually from next week's Parsha, not this week's, but I think, you know, the Torah goes together in many ways, and in a lot of ways the division into Parshiot is somewhat artificial, and it does immediately follow this week's Parsha, so I give myself a certain license to include it. And I think you see right away that this is the Mikra Bikurim, right? The mitzvah Bikurim of bringing the first fruits to the temple. And when someone does that, they are required to read this sort of very, very short summarized version of Jewish history, or of everything that has happened to the Jewish people until they enter into the land of Israel. So first, I just want to, for review's sake, it would just be good to read it quickly. So I'm just going to read it for us. I'll just read it in English. When you have entered the land the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance and have taken possession of it and settled in it, take some of the first fruits of all that you produce from the soil of the land the Lord your God is giving you and put them in a basket. Then go to the place the Lord your God will choose as a dwelling for his name and say to the priest in office at the time, I declare today to the Lord your God that I have come to the land the Lord swore to our ancestors to give us. The priest shall take the basket from your hands and set it down in front of the altar and of the Lord your God. Okay, now, if we would have just stopped there, I think we would have all been very satisfied in the quality of this mitzvah, right? Because basically what the mitzvah of Bikurim is that we sort of take, we sort of give thanks to God, right? So here we're taking our first fruits, we're bringing them, to the Lord your God in the temple. And by giving them, it's almost obvious why we're doing it and that the mitzvah should have some kind of effect on us in terms of recognizing the thanksgiving that we are due to give to God. But nevertheless, the Torah continues. Then you shall declare before the Lord your God, my father was a wandering Aramean, and he went down into Egypt with a few people and lived there and became a great nation, powerful and numerous. But the Egyptians mistreated us and made us suffer, subjecting us to harsh labor. Then we cried out to the Lord, the God of our ancestors, and the Lord heard our voice and saw our misery, toil, and oppression. So the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand and outstretched arm, with great terror and with signs and wonders. He brought us to this place and gave us his land, a land flowing with milk and honey. And now I bring the first fruits of the soil that you, Lord, have given me. Place the basket before the Lord your God and bow down before him. Then you and the Levites and the foreigners residing among you shall rejoice in all the good things the Lord your God has given to you and your household. Okay, so I think it becomes very clear very quickly here that here we're asked to put something of great importance into a much larger context, right? It's not just some individual random farmer that is bringing a few figs to the temple and saying that, yeah, God, I thank you. I you're great, God. You know, I realize everything is from you, right? That's the point of the mitzvah. But the mitzvah is much more than that. It's about our entire story of the Jewish people. And if you're familiar with the Mishnah in Masechah Bikurim, this was done to great pomp and circumstance, right? When the Bikurim was actually done, there were parades and people were bedecked in wonderful clothing and there was gold and all kinds of different things. You can read the details in the Masechet Bikurim of the Mishnah, but that is being done or we're required to do it in that form in order to show again that this is part of the Jewish people's history. It's not just a random act of some individual farmer somewhere. And I think that when we recognize that the Pesach Seder, the Magid, right, the most important part of the Seder is around these verses, right? It's rabbinic midrash around these verses, right? So if you remember, or if you don't, and you look in the Haggadah, you'll see that a verse is quoted, and then some rabbinic midrash is quoted on it, and then another verse is quoted, and then more rabbinic midrash is quoted on it. And one can very easily ask themselves, and many people have, right? You would think that in terms of celebrating our holiday of freedom, the main text of the Haggadah would be from the story itself, right? Of what happened, right? From Parshat Va'era, Parshat Bo, right? Parshat Beshalach, the story of the plagues and the enslavement of Egypt and the exodus from Egypt and all of that, right? Because that is the story if we're talking about stories, right? But I think this makes the whole point here. The story is not just to remember something that happened in the past, right? That is one aspect of storytelling, that we remember what happened in the past. But the point of a story is to direct our actions and our life as both an individual and a people in the future, right? And therefore, this section talks about the future, right? About coming into the land of Israel and building a temple and having Kohanim and being able to give our thanks. So I think that I've tried to sort of review a bunch of different mitzvot and try to show the importance of placing ourselves within a story, contextualizing everything we do within that grander story, and not just seeing the laws of the Torah as, you know, one law after the other, which are disconnected, but really all of them having the same goal. Putting them in context sort of shows us and conveys us to the reasons for some of them and gives us a greater indication as to how we're, you know, how we are commanded to sort of perfect the world. So I hope I've been sort of thinking about this since my bar mitzvah. It's interesting that I'll just say in terms of I've been collecting a lot of these sources and I have hundreds more, but in doing some preparation for this, I, you know, put law as story or law as narrative. in Google, and some of the first things that come up are some articles by Rabbi Jay Kelman. So I urge you to read them on the Torah in Motion website. That just happens to be a coincidence, but I see there are some comments. So the point of the narrative of Mikra Bikurim is to put in the context of Brit Bein HaBetarim. What you are acknowledging is that Hashem has fulfilled his promise of Brit Bein HaBetarim. That's why you use the core of the Haggadah coming right after the Vehisha Amda. Excellent. Yeah. Right. I didn't necessarily go into the details of how it's, how it is contextualizing everything, but I think you're right on point here. Jennifer, thank you very much for giving us such an interesting lecture. My pleasure. Thank you for participating. The heart of the Haggadah should be set at Shavuot, but since we are no longer redeemed, but awaiting redemption, whatever that means, we moved it to Passover, awaiting redemption. Okay, there's a lot to say about the connections between Pesach and Shavuot. One is physical redemption, then is spiritual redemption. There's a lot, said and written on that. But yeah, I accept that as being a very fair point as well. So, so it's 4:27 a.m. here in Israel. So that means we have 3 minutes left. So I guess if anyone wants to say anything, questions. I'm going back to sleep.
Yeah, you're going back to sleep. We can let you go back to sleep early. I'm impressed. I don't know how much coffee you had before starting.
No, I did go to sleep and wake up. I haven't been up all night.
No, of course. I realize. Okay, I got you. I got you.
Now this is bringing me back to my Corona days, so when I spent literally almost 24/7 in this office, on this computer on Zoom. One of the things we did in Corona, my organization, is that, we have rabbis that have been through our training program all throughout Israel, and, around 11 or 12 of them happen to be in Modi'in, where I happen to live. One, there are a lot of reasons for that. The most important one is because Modi'in is fast becoming, one of the most important cities in Israel. It's growing at leaps and bounds, very interesting relationships, positive relationships between religious and non-religious and all kinds of things. So there are a lot of new pulpit rabbis here. And anyway, so since we have so many rabbis in Modi'in, the city asked us during Corona to help organize a major, major volunteer effort to get food out to people, older and sick people who couldn't come, none of us could come out of our homes. But we were literally running a volunteer effort several times a week, delivering food to thousands of people. And I mostly sat in this where I am right now for many, many hours. So it sort of brings me back to that moment. So it's not good to be reminded of Corona, but, it is good to be reminded that we were able to at least help a few people. So I see someone raising their hand. It just says iPad. Toronto, somebody want to say something?
Sure. Well, I don't doubt that you do good work, probably excellent work. Isn't the problem with the Israeli model, which the rabbis are hired from a bureaucracy far removed from Amcha, whereas in North America and Europe, the congregation gets together with their own money and hires a rabbi who then has to be responsive or they get canned? Right. Whereas if you're beholden to bureaucracy, all you're doing is the future rabbis will still have the same issue because of how they're hired and trained, which the Israeli model is not a good model.
Right. So first of all, I should bring you along on my fundraising trips because you are 1,000% right. I couldn't have said it better myself. Right. There are a lot of problems with the rabbinate in Israel, both with a big R and a small R, a lot of challenges. That has been the model in Israel. But it's that's not our model, meaning we're trying to bring in the model of no bureaucracy, straight reporting and working for the congregants, exactly as you're talking about.
But this is the old issue between the North American automakers and the Japanese automakers. The Japanese elected to fix the problems before they started in the manufacturing, and the North American said, when a customer complains, when we'll fix the car on the warranty. And you saw the North American auto industry failed.
Right. So I can take responsibility I can't do something about what came before me, but the model, the good model that you're talking about of people being responsive directly to their congregants, being paid by their congregants, not having any bureaucracy. That is the model of all of the rabbis that we have trained. They are all hired and paid directly by their congregation. They have nothing to do. I mean, they may have something to do, but they have nothing officially to do. They're not appointed. They're not hired by any chief rabbi, any, you know, any city committee or anything. They're hired very much by their and report directly to their congregants. So you are spot on about both the problem and the solution. And what you're doing is what you're suggesting is actually exactly what we're trying to do. But if I go all around the world talking about a lot of about this exact issue, it's actually very interesting to many people, and I'm more than happy to come to Toronto. Actually, I have been in Toronto to talk about it before, but always willing to, you know, do that again and to continue the conversation.
Go on. I don't want to
go on.
No, I was just going to think this is the kind of stuff that you don't hear about in the newspaper. I agree 1,000% and more. I've often said one of the tragedies of Israel, if I can use that word, is that it's a Western European country. It's a Western country with an Eastern European rabbinate. And an Eastern European rabbinate doesn't work in a Western country.
It's not even an Eastern European rabbinate. An Eastern European rabbinate is wonderful compared to what we have.
I understand. I get it. But in terms of the focus on halakha, you said it. The rabbi,
right,
you know.
Right.
You know, if we want to get into something, since half the people left already, if we want to get into something really controversial, I love Adam Furziger, who I'm sure you know. His analysis of the OU tshuva, the O-U-R-C-A tshuva on women rabbis. And I think it was absolutely brilliant when he said the things that the OU and, you know, the YU rabbi said, or mainly YU rabbi said, is are forbidden, are the things that they permitted are teaching Torah, that it's fine. A woman can teach Torah, more opportunities. That was the role of the rabbi in Eastern Europe. The things they prohibited, the woman giving sermons and doing weddings and funerals and the brother, you know, all that stuff, that was an invention of the Reform movement. The Reform movement, right, changed the nature of the rabbinate. And Professor Adam Furziger, professor of sociology at Bar Ilan University, who went to YU with me, etc., been living in Israel a long time with Bar Ilan. And it was just fascinating that he said basically what they prohibited was the to be a Reform rabbi, and they permitted to be like the old Talmud Chacham in Europe. It was just, I thought, a fascinating analysis. I don't know if you have any comments.
I remember seeing that when it came out, but I never read it. Our problem here in Israel, I mean, is that most people don't know this, and this is sort of the historical talk I give when I do travel, is that Ben Gurion himself wanted to do away with the notion of the Jewish community as it existed for 2000 years. And therefore, all of the communal needs that were usually provided for by the Jewish community and the leadership of the Jewish community, for obvious reasons, he wanted transferred to the state, including religious services, right? And that's why we have a chief rabbinate and all that. But what most people don't know is that the way Jewish community works in Israel is unlike the way it has worked for 2000 years. It's a revolution, and it's not necessarily a good revolution, because I'm not talking about the politics of the chief rabbinate and Geirut and all. Everyone has their own opinions on that. I have my own opinions on that. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the fact that people don't really live in community and don't have communal leadership. And the synagogue has really become a place where most Israelis, I'm not talking about Anglo Israelis, because they live in many ways in the same way that they did before, where they came from. But Israelis, they go to synagogue, they daven, they maybe hear a nice sermon, they maybe go to a shir, but there's nothing more than that, right? And so what you have is many people who go to shul three times a day, who are Shomer Shabbos, Shomer Kashrus, and don't really live as part of a community. And it's very debilitating in a lot of ways. But anyway, there's a lot more to talk about, but I have 2 hours so I need to get up.
Yeah, go to sleep. I agree with you 1,000%. Right. Yossi, thank you. And really, thank you very much for getting up, and happy birthday a month late, 42 years.
Thank you very much, Rabbi. All right. Excellent work.
Thank you.
I know there are only a few people left here, but I just want to give a advertisement. I recently, not a few months ago, came back from Tunisia, with Professor Mark Shapiro with Torah in Motion Travel. And if you don't know Professor Shapiro or haven't been with him, sign up as soon as it's possible for next summer.
Please God, we're going to be running the Tunisia trip this January. As you know, we missed the trip because our granddaughter was born during that trip. I mean, we knew she was expecting, so we couldn't go on the trip. And so please God, we will be running to it because it was about 114 degrees in the middle of the day in the summer. Right. They could only go touring in the morning and the evening. So we're going to go in January where it's in a nice weather. So so please God, yes. But I haven't been to Tunisia yet, but thank you for that. And yes, we also have to tell a story because as someone who started their own organization, I know what it's like to have to raise money. Right. And it's you're right, you got to tell a story, and it's day in and day out. It's the, I think we both agree, it's the part of the job we least like the best, but it's Imein Kemafein Torah. But yes, tell story.
Okay, thank you very much. Have a wonderful Shabbos.
Thank you. Thank you. And of course, okay. Tomorrow morning, of course, I'll be giving my regular shiur in the Siddur at 9:30. We're still in the first paragraph of the Shema. Next Friday, I'm going to start on the Machzor. Do a little bit, but tomorrow we'll still be on the Siddur. Everybody, welcome at 9:30. Next week, we'll have all the shiur we're having this week, except we'll be adding Benny Gesundheit. We'll be adding his shiur on the difference between the Bavli and the Yerushalmi. And Tfilah. So we look forward to seeing you. Rabbi Liebtag, of course, will begin the week on Monday, Sunday morning at 11:15 Eastern. And everybody have a wonderful night. Shabbat Shalom. And maybe we'll see you tomorrow, next week. And please invite a friend. And Laila Tov, everybody. Or Boker Tov for those who are in Israel. Really, I really think he got up at 3 in the morning to give the shiur. Really, Yashar Koach. Okay. Laila Tov, everybody.
Laila Tov.